Today's talk, given by Professor Clive Sable of the University of Bristol. His talk is entitled The Behavel, the Next Frontier in Environmental Exposure Modelling. Professor Sable works with individual level data. This can mean working with point pattern data of a residential location to reveal epidemiological relationships to environmental exposures, building whole life course exposures to social and environmental sources to, for example, understand well-being in urban areas, or data mining big data such as Twitter feeds for spatiotemporal trends. Following a BSc honours in Geography from Lancaster in 1990 and an MSc in GIS from Edinburgh in 1991, around about then, Clive spent some time travelling before returning to Lancaster in 1996, completing his PhD in 1999 under Tony Cottrell and Robin Flerger, using an exploratory spatial data analysis, which all of you are now familiar with, approach to investigate spatial and temporal relationships between environmental exposure and health. Clive then worked as postdoc at St Andrews with Professor Paul Boyle and then at Karolinska University in Sweden for accepting a lectureship at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand in 2004. He returned to the UK in 2007, joining Imperial, and returned to Geography in 2009, becoming Associate Professor and then Professor next year. And in September 2013, he joined the University of Bristol as Professor of Quantitative Geography. So with such a wealth of experience in the quantitative and health domains, I look forward to fascinating talk.
Great, thanks very much, Owen, and thanks everybody for inviting me here. It's lovely to come back to where I was a student and to be greeted by this, which is got a lovely picture of Bruce here, and I remember this slide, Bruce, from 23 years ago. And look, Bruce looks so young in this picture. Yeah, these are exactly the same slides, so sorry to embarrass you, but it's good to be back. So I'm a geographer, a GI scientist, and I have increasingly moved my work into the health geography area. So what I'm going to try and do today is talk about both those aspects, and particularly with talking about a project that I'm working on called HEALS with a couple of colleagues in the corner, Miranda, wave your hand, Miranda, who I acknowledge in this talk. I've borrowed some of her work for this as well. I should say before I start, I absolutely don't mind you interrupting me as I talk. If you need clarification or you want to just raise a point as I'm talking, but I think there will be questions at the end as well. But I do have to. I've got a taxi booked for 5:40 to catch the flight out. So I think we're going to try and finish. Can make sure I finish. Good. So the kind of thing that I wanted to talk to you all about today was. Is this idea of health geography, and how does health geography work and link to GIS? So we all know that, I'm sure most of us know, that when we all have a health status, and that our health status and diseases that we might get, and particular ailments, could be caused by genetics or environment, or some combination of the both. And what I'm trying to do today is build up a conceptual framework about how we, in the future, can try and counter the large amount of work that's been done in the genetic field by pushing the environment as a valid field of study. The kind of questions that we typically would be asking as geographers will be those space-time questions. For how long have people lived in a place that might have created conditions which perhaps in later life might manifest in a disease such as cancer or Alzheimer's or indeed other minor ailments. As you know, space, place, location and time are really, really critical, and one of the things that you might get from the talk today is how we can spatially and temporally resolve that nowadays using the kind of tools that I'm sure most of you have been taught about in the master's degree, and then perhaps some of you in your professional life will be aware of it too. So up to now, this field of environmental exposure science and environmental epidemiology roughly works like this. The traditional approach is that when we're trying to understand what causes disease, we assume that people are rather static. At best, we might know that you live in a census area or perhaps in a particular house if we're really good, but we assume that you've lived all your life at that location. We probably have got very little idea about where you've lived in the past. We probably don't know where you work and how you move through your day-to-day lives, or indeed through your year life. You know, do you perhaps go on holidays in certain places? Do you have two homes and you move between them in different seasons? Do you go home to family at certain times of the holidays, and such like? So that, obviously, that static idea of how we capture people is erroneous, because it doesn't capture all that lovely stuff that we do on a day-to-day basis. We all happen to be in this room right now, but afterwards we'll all go back to our homes, and I'll fly back to Bristol, and we'll therefore have very, very different exposures after this meeting. And the kind of work that I'm going to be talking about today is a methodology for capturing that, to help better explain how people such as ourselves get disease in the future. So what we don't do is this critical fit. We don't currently estimate exposure by tracking individuals through their daily lives. Hence this absolutely brand new, well, sort of 10-year-old paradigm. It's a big paradigm shift called the exposome. It's the idea of the genome for the environment. So it's pushing this big new area. We know that 2/3 of deaths worldwide are caused by non-communicable diseases. That's non-infectious diseases. We also know that about 10% are due to genetic causes alone. That leaves at least 90% that are caused by other factors, which probably include most of them caused by the environment. And by the environment, I want to be very all-inclusive. I don't just mean the physical environment, but the social environment, and so the social and the physical sides of geography that are so important. Now, a huge amount of money and research effort over the last 20 years, as we all know, has gone into characterising the human genome, and we've mapped that pretty well now. But the field of exposure science has most definitely not yet caught up to the genetic side. So that's what I'm going to be pushing for in the rest of this talk. Now, it's not actually a new idea. So if we... That's laser working. 1790, so over 200 years ago, people such as John Wallace created this diagram from where individuals characterised from birth, as they go through their lives, to end of life and death, talks about the idea that we, and to try and characterise what is now called the exposome, where the totality of exposure from physical and social environments, so that's capturing those two points I mentioned before, lifestyle, behaviour, etc., during the whole life, from conception through to death, are brought together in a model to help us understand diseases, particularly diseases that we don't really know what causes them now. So think of the neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. We hope that the kind of approach that we're putting forward here will really help those diseases. So the exposome was coined in 2005 by a chap called Wild, an American researcher. That's in there. I'm tending to put up references in the bottom there, please. I think the slides will be made available at the end. Do follow them up if you like. There'll be five or six different references through the talk. So Wild talked about creating a framework where we can pull together all environmental influences, including those behavioural types of influences, as I say, from conception onwards, to create an idea about disease etiology, which is the causes of disease. Now, the exposome has got lots of issues around it. It's a hugely complex data mining problem that we're setting up here. But one of the key things we do know to try and shortcut that is that there are key points in one's life, what we call critical periods, when we are developing very fast, either just after birth, during puberty and early adulthood, when we feel that we need to focus more of the effort. So we are aware that although we need to know about the totality of the exposure, there are some times in one's life when it's more important. Okay. That does vary by different socioeconomic groups, and by gender, but there are normal times. So, Wiles, and again, here's a different paper, characterised the exposed zone as being consisting of three separate but overlapping circles. Internal to the body, if you like the more genetic stuff, let's put that to one side because I'm not going to talk about that. General external things, which as you can see include a lot of social geography concepts like social capital, mental stress, urban, rural environments, climate and such like. And then very specific external ones, and those indeed include lifestyle factors such as whether we're all drinking wine as we're giving a talk, or whether we're having a smoke or something or another. And those I, and this is the bit that I've added to this whole debate, I'm calling the behavome, i.e. how does how we behave influence our exposure to things? Now the exposed zone you might have heard of before, you might not have. But one thing as an academic researcher you can't ignore is that it's a very fundable area. Mr. Pierce is late. Shame on you. The exposed zone has attracted about 35 million euros of funding in the last 3 or 4 years on both the EU and the US side. I'm involved with one particular project, the HEALS project, and I'll talk to you about that in a minute. Do please use those URLs to follow up more about them. What's really interesting about all these things is that a lot of geographers are involved in these projects. And a lot of people who know some aspects of GIS are also in them too. Now, I've talked more about the physical environment. I just want to put this slide up to note that it's really important that we don't forget the social environment. And by the social environment, I imagine some of you know this material really well. But it is postulated that social exposures are as important, if not more important, than physical environmental ones. We can ask questions such as, how does our well-being respond to differing social environments? We know as we navigate our lives through a day-to-day basis that our mental health varies depending on who we're interacting with, whether we've got a nice friendly group of people, or whether you feel alien in a group, whether when you're walking across a city, whether you feel scared because it's a vulnerable environment for you, it's not something you're familiar with. Also, issues such as health-related behaviours, which we touched on before, such as smoking and alcohol consumption and diet, are really important and influence these things. I do want to note that a lot of these exposures vary differently according to if you're a member of a vulnerable population. I think nearly everybody is a member of one of these types of people. If you're young, old, relatively poor, you come from an ethnic minority, if you're sick, of course that's a vulnerable group, or depending on your gender. So the kind of work that I'm going to talk about in the second half of the talk will be really focusing on developing a methodology to understand how different groups in society can be differentially impacted. So the work that I've just got accepted, I'll pop that slide up first so you know what I'm talking about. So in the panels of the AAG, we've got a paper that's called the Genetic GIS Towards a Place-Based Synthesis of the Genome, Exposed Zone and Behavome, that should come out. It's been in press for 6 months now, but so it should come out very shortly. Has this diagram in it. And it's where we've put health being both sides, the positive sides of health, the well-being and the negative sides of the illness, at the centre of the diagram, surrounded by the exposed zone and the behavioure that I've talked to you about before, adding to the existing genome. And the kind of thing we're thinking is that the, if you talk, think of another word that's impossible to pronounce, but environment is consisting of your genetic background, what you're born with, something to do with the environment that you live and move into and around, and some component of how you behave in those environments. And that all builds up into a picture which, if we aggregate across all the population in the whole country or across the whole world, will help us understand why different kinds of people get diseases and others don't. So we get to the point where you're asking, how does this really relate to GIS or GI science? So I'm now going to try and join those two aspects together. I don't know if people are familiar with this diagram. It's a very old, but now it's nearly 40 years old, just over 40 years old, from Torsten Hegerstrand. This is actually taken from my PhD, so this is even dating me a bit. The basic idea that Torsten came up with is very simple, is that we've got an XYZ prism there, and that this red line represents an individual as they hypothetically navigate their lives through time. It could be a day, let's call it this a day. And that through the day, they intersect with potentially hazardous things. Think of it as a noisy environment, or a polluted road, or a stressful lecture, who knows what. So people, and in this case, you know, they're unexposed, and then they're exposed during this time, and then they move around and not exposed. They're exposed again, they move around and exposed at the end of the day. Obviously, that's really simple. Lots of people move in more complicated ways than that, and there's multiple exposures that people could potentially have. But that's the idea that Torsten came up with. It's called the space-time prism. And people such as Michael Kwan in the US are famous within the GI science literature for doing this kind of work. And she coined the phrase the space-time aquarium. So Maipo did this work here in Portland in the US. And although it's exploratory analysis, I think it's really interesting. Don't know if you can read the details from the back, but the purple lines represent African American people as they move through Portland, whereas the blue lines, the lighter blue lines, represent Asian American women. And I don't know who in the room could describe that to me, but has anybody got, you know, what do you think that image is showing? Anybody like to offer something?
One's more spatially restricted.
Yeah, and the one that's more restricted is the Black American. There might be lots of cultural reasons why that is the case. Would we have known that if we hadn't mapped it in this way? It should be obvious, but time is on the z-axis here. There must be fundamental reasons why different cohorts or groups in society move differently. And it's that difference that we're really interested in unpacking for the work that I'm trying to set up for you today. And this links back to really old work now of mine. During my PhD, I worked in Finland. I had very, very similar data, and I did very similar things, published now quite a while ago, looking at wherever people ever moved in Finland who, in later life, got a really nasty disease called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or motor neuron disease, you might know of it as. And that, unfortunately, there's no cure, and you die within 2 or 3 years. So it's a really nasty disease. And it's exactly the kind of disease that I'm suggesting that the methodology that I'm putting forward here can help to solve. So what we did was, in here we've got lots of little dots, we've got 1,000 people, and we tracked them, and we did some complex Monte Carlo simulation, and started off with kernel estimation. Then have you come across kernel estimation yet in the masters? People have you taught them yet, Bruce? Not yet. Neil? It's coming. So in ArcGIS, there's a function to create smooth surfaces of things, and kernel estimation is one of those techniques. During my PhD, I worked at ESRI in Redlands, California, to implement that algorithm in their software, and then I used it for my PhD. So let me explain what that's about. That's a hypothetical. That's the same kind of thing as what we talked about before, but with my data, people live statically, move, and through life. And if you take lots of slices of data at a certain time, day by day, for 20 years, you can end up showing an analysis like this. This goes from 1965 to 1990. Finland, I've got it on a continuous loop here, so we can just focus on certain areas. But it's the same kind of thing, showing in 2D what we were showing in 3D before in Portland, Oregon. So if you focus, first of all, just on that black dot there, this black area here is a high, as you can note, this was the first time that anybody found in the world, for that particular disease, evidence of space-time clustering, which was the first clue as to what might be causing this disease. You go there, it's a very rural part of Finland, not many people live there, they have an unusual genetic background, but they also have an unusual environmental exposure set of circumstances. That's quite a static area where it's always black in the analysis, always an extreme high. And I haven't put on lots of significance contours, but because that computes the image, but believe me, that's a significant high. There are other areas, and I'll let the loop start. It's in here, it's very black to start with, and then it goes very white at the end. So there are other areas where disease is obviously apparent in some part of the data set and then disappears as people move in and out, or perhaps as the environment changes. That's the idea of this kind of exploratory work, to develop hypotheses which you can then go ahead and test. So, any questions about this before I move on to the next rather different topic? Do you understand that? So, the way we're looking at doing this now is to use the latest kind of technologies. One of those is this huge proliferation that we see now about personal monitoring and personal tracking. So who in the room has got a Fitbit type thing? One of you, just one of you. Miranda, you don't have one? No? I'll see that. You don't? No. I don't either. But I do have a smartphone, and the smartphone does nearly everything that we're talking about now. You know that the smartphone obviously tracks our location and using numerous different technologies from cell phone through to GPS and such like. But there are a lot more sensors out there. So for example, you can now get a contact lens that has an imprinted little tracker on it itself. We can get a tattoo that can tattoo on the skin that can track you if you agree to it. We all know about the Google glasses. There are other kinds of sensors as well, such as the Fitbit type of sensors, which we ostensibly use just to make sure that we're doing the kind of exercise that we want to do. But remember that the companies behind them, Fitbit particularly, is collecting all that data on you all the time. And indeed, do you know, they're now selling that data on for profit. Do you know that? It's really interesting. So we're working in the project, trying to understand how best we can do a scientific piece of work, perhaps using rather commercial sensors and technologies. So yeah, lots of different ways that people are being tracked or indeed are agreeing to be tracked, both in terms of their location, but more than that, sensing something else about the environment. It might be an air pollution sampler, it might be a UV sampler, it might be a noise meter, it could be lots of things. And then the other side of all of this is what I'm sure you all know about big data, is that there's this huge amount of data that we are either collecting through government agencies, like the stuff that we've been doing for a long time, such as health registers and censuses, But also we're generating ourselves increasingly every time we tweet or engage with social media. And the point is, can we use all of that to understand how people move? So I haven't, but I could have tweeted today, and that location could have been located to me here in Edinburgh. And that would have been a best estimate for me if I hadn't had other devices turned on, as to the fact that I was in Edinburgh and not in Bristol today. Well, Google tracked my history all the time, and Google could have told me where I was in Edinburgh better than Twitter can. But, of course, using all this crowdsourced information is incredibly valuable because we have, although not as accurate data, we've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions of data points being generated all the time. And the idea that we can actually capture all of this work to understand how different groups of people move and interact and engage with different groups in society, I think is really exciting. So that's what we're trying to do there as well. We have time. So the last sort of half of the talk now, I want to talk about the specifics of the project that I'm working on called HEALS, which tries to build that theory and the GI science together and to see and try and answer how we're coming up with a methodology to inform the work that the EU are funding. Just acknowledge the fact that we've got FP7 funding to do that. So the project's called HEALS, Health and Environment-Wide Associations Based on Large Population Surveys. It's a huge consortium of people. As you saw, it's €12 million funding, which each of us only get a few hundred thousand to do our own work within the project. Obviously, there's people looking at internal body exposures, external body, people interested in technology. There's epidemiologists collecting new cohort data on twins that are just being born. So a huge study doing lots of different things. But you can imagine what I'm interested in doing. I said that already. So one of the things that Miranda in the corner and I are working on together is a pilot study trying to understand how people move and using existing technologies to reveal a lot more resolution spatially and temporally. So we're using, Fitbit, but Fitbit-type technologies, and indeed something called Move. I don't know if anybody's heard of Move. It's a really simple it's an app that's indeed here, which you can, it's very much like Fitbit. It tracks how much activity you do in a day, but critically, it also starts to characterise the kind of activity that you're doing. So it will say that you'll be able to say that you're walking, running, in a car, sat at an office desk, and then it will start to also understand your life because it learns. So it will learn that you're in the home, and your home, or in your work. It will know that you're in a supermarket that you've been to before, or the library, or wherever. So it starts to identify a lot about the individuals after a certain amount of time. And that's really interesting. So we've got, in this pilot study, seven different cities, including Edinburgh here, along this, by complete coincidence, isn't it, Randa? It's not meant to be a straight line, but it almost is practically a straight line. Although what we are trying to do in all of these studies is understand how people move in very different climates, so from north to south Europe. It's only a pilot study, so we're just looking at four people per institute being followed for 7 days, and we're currently analysing that data as we speak. But, for example, we're already starting to get some really interesting things out. So one of the things we've got is a temperature sensor, a simple temperature sensor. So we might not know if an individual is indoors or outdoors, but we can start to use a sensor like a temperature sensor to tell us whether they're indoors or outdoors. So if you look, we've annotated this into this one individual from 7 a.m. through to 8 p.m. in the evening with the kind of things that they were telling us afterwards they were doing, such as, walking the dog, driving to meetings, at work, and such like. So the blue line is the temperature, and you can see it goes from 0 to 30 degrees Celsius. But we can see these sharp cutoffs give us a very good idea that a person has moved environment. That's when they're moving from indoors and outdoors. join that with this idea of we're getting a time activity diary, a TAD, which can be either electronically captured through through an app, or indeed just afterwards we can ask them to say, tell us what you were doing today and write it down, and then we match that to the sensors. That's a nice validation of what people are telling us they were doing. And of course this is stuff that everybody should know about, of course it's GPS tracking, but that's an essential element to what we're trying to do. This is just a simple Google Earth image here, but the red line is somebody driving into a leisure pursuit and then getting on a bike, and in blue having a bike ride. So not only are we using GPS to track people, but we're able to use GPS to divide the kind of activity, to know what kind of physical exercise people are doing. And this is where it gets really exciting and, I've got to say, hugely complicated. We know quite a lot about how people move, but we don't know everybody. Not everybody uses smartphones, not everybody uses technology. We're probably all aware of people who don't use those kind of technologies. My parents are classic examples of them. So what we're trying to do is we're using a technology that some of you might have heard of called agent-based modelling to try and fill in the gaps of those people that we don't know. Of course, the way agent-based modelling works is that you have to assign behaviours to, literally agents, but think of them as people, and give them characteristics and behaviours, and let them move within an artificial world. And here we've got an artificial city with houses in it, and we've artificially created a start-off circumstances on which then people... In those houses, iterate and move. So, for example, we could ask questions such as, do different ethnicities move differently in their lives? And remember that work from Maipo Kwan in the US, in Portland? We know that, in that case, black women lived and operated within different space to Asian women in Portland at that time. So we're trying to use technologies like agent-based modelling to help us fill in where we don't know enough. So it's got some problems and complexities with that technology, but we hope to do that. And of course, that's core GI science as well. I'm coming towards the end of my talk, so what I'm bringing together with two or three slides. What we're trying to do is we're trying to use technologies like Fitbit, or indeed an app like Moves, together with existing sensors, air pollution sensors, or temperature and wind and rainfall sensors, to build a spatial model of what's happening in the environment, that might be a social environment or a physical environment. And traditionally, that's all you would know. You would know that, let's say that was the middle of Edinburgh, that there was more or less of a certain pollutant, let's say PM10 is the stuff you don't want to be breathing in too much, comes out of car exhaust and such like. And that there's more of it down busy roads and less in other places. That's all we've known in the past. Now we know that individuals will be navigating that same space and will be interacting in that ellipse, that red ellipse there, with a polluted environment. So we know that individuals, we're much better able to characterise their exposure. That's what really we're trying to achieve. And acknowledge Suzanne's PhD. Suzanne's just finished a PhD with me looking at these aspects. And if I spend some time on this slide, in the end, this is probably what we're trying to do for one person, but then we need to wrap that up to huge populations. So this is a period of 24 hours, or just over 24 hours, where we have tracked a person and using a number of different technologies, including asking them, very low technology as well, where they, what kind of environments they were in. And in this case, we had a little sensor on there and on the backpack to measure PM2.5, a relatively small diameter of PM, the kind of stuff that comes out of car exhausts. And we can see that people, this person on this particular day, was probably at home. We know that they said they were at home. And they had very low, see, it's almost background levels of of PM2.5, that they woke up at about 8 o'clock, and they woke up at about 7 o'clock, started moving around the house, and at 8 o'clock they went on a particular form of transport. I can't remember what it is, Suzanne probably doesn't remember. Let's say it was a bus, where their exposure went up a little bit, but not very much. And then they were at work for most of the day, with certain peaks through the day for certain things, but they're not very high. And at the end of the day, they went home again, and then they were outdoors. And when they were outdoors, there were really high peaks, so sort of 6-7 times a peak that they would be doing in their background level. Now, this one is particularly interesting. This actual profile is taken from somebody in Edinburgh, and that person there, at that particular time, I don't know if it's even fair for me to ask, can you guess where that is? But it's in Waverley train station. They were there collecting a ticket for a moment, and that was where that peak exposure occurred. And if any of you, I'm sure most of you have been into Waverley, you know that the diesel engines and it sit there, and that it's an largely enclosed space, and you intuitively feel it's polluted. This shows for that day that it was. And then they go home, they're in a public building, I can't remember what it was, Suzanne, do you remember what it was for this particular person?
I think it was a coffee shop.
Yeah, okay, so a coffee shop where the rate is much higher than their home background, and then they went home, and then there's a gap here, and that was where they were.
They went to a concert.
Okay. They were not allowed, yeah, but it hummed, so they'd have to turn it off when they're in a concert. There are other gaps in data which always occur, for example, if the battery fails or they forgot to take it with them to work or whatever. So there were always these problems, and then they went home. So that's one sample, and we've got lots of different transects like this. There are other really interesting ones when people burn food at home, and it just goes ballistic. It goes like it goes up to, in your case, it went up to 200 parts per meter cube as opposed to 20, so 10 times these rates if people burn something in their house. And then really interestingly, it takes 8 hours to drop back to the background level. So once you burn, and one of the key messages from this is, if you burn anything in your house, open all the windows and put your extractor fans on immediately and shut the kitchen door, because it propagated around the whole house, including the bedroom where the sensor was. Suzanne published this early last year in, did really well together, published in a really good journal. So that, in the end, is the kind of thing that we're trying to understand for lots and lots of people and different kinds of people. And you can see it's quite challenging. We, in the end, don't care about the geography, but it's because it's only an intermediate step that we're interested in, is the where the space and the time interact with the exposures. Because in the end, we're adding up that and understanding whether a peak is more important than a general background rate or not. And then we use that to create ideas and new ideas about what causes disease and then, of course, in the end, help to understand the explanations for disease and then help solve some major etiological problems. So I think that's my last slide. Thanks very much for your attention and your questions. So we've got lots of time for a few more. Okay, thanks very much. Geography and GIS is a real problem. have to use methods, complex methods, that are very, very data hungry, and that we're probably dealing with 20 or 30 cases within that whole cluster. So, although it's really interesting, it's made up of quite a small number of people. And one of the other caveats I've put in there is it depends on how we characterise how you think non-infected people move as to exactly what we find in those numbers of clusters. We haven't done the next stage, we probably never will, but it's not the work that I do, to identify a specific cause. But the literature points to environmental stresses like air pollution as a clue, but so you know, air pollution is not indicated in the ALS measurement. There's a question in front of the next.
Yeah, to what extent are the other sort of academic communities, epidemiologists, geneticists, etc., are they fully appreciative of the role of GI in this, or do they see it as a bit of a silo that they're not really interested in?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. It's the job that I have, and the people that are working in the project that we're working on, to it's not seen as mainstream geography, obviously, and most of the big teams are made up of epidemiologists of some kind or another, or exposure scientists. I think GIS is a mature technology in part of this field, so people are aware of some of the possibilities, but I'm often fairly, I mean, ask the same question to the colleagues behind you, I'm a fairly lone voice in a larger group of people. One of the problems is that our range of technologies is first very fast evolving, but is also quite complex to explain. So it's quite a challenge to explain simply what the value that we can add to the existing studies. So,
is that also a methodological thing? Do you want to know what kind of data they would have to produce to allow you to work with it?
I do agree that it is a methodological problem. I think as we get more and more familiar with using, I mean, even in the last 5 years, the rise of things like Google Earth, and then all our smartphones are tracking us all the time, and we're more and more comfortable with that. I think that's less and less of a problem. I think we sort of don't have to start from the beginning explaining everything anymore. Do you mind if I sort of ask Miranda as well, who sits on the other side of that, as an exposure scientist? Do you have a perspective to answer on them? You know what GIS is. Yeah. How do we inform it? So might, let's just say, take a cohort. Let's let's say Pakistanis in the UK. Do they behave similarly to Pakistanis in East Europe? Do women in Edinburgh behave similarly or differently to those in Poland or Greece? So we're going to have to develop rules because the agent-based modelling needs rules to be seeded. And then we iterate and we can set it off to go and understand how people work. So the kind of high, let me backtrack here. Why are we trying to use agent-based modelling is just to fill in the gaps because we can't survey everything. What can agent-based modelling give us? We hope that it will tell us, for example, that certain groups in society behave in a day differently to others. Let's say, let's give a completely neutral example. Men are the primary baby carers. This is an example. That their wives go off to work, but men all take the children to the daycare centre. They interact and coalesce together at the daycare centre. They might socialise together. They might then go home and pick up the children, and then their partners come home. So that environment might be very different in Sweden, where that kind of model is not too far fetched, but it might be very unusual in Southern and Eastern Europe. So we know that hypothetically. We know that we can know that from papers. We can use other sources of information to which we can then seed our models and see the impact of that. So it's not, we can't answer that question right now because it's a 5-year project, we're 1 year in. But it's the most challenging thing that the colleagues that are in the room here and around Europe are thinking about at the moment. It's, it was a nice idea when we put the bid in. But now we're trying to actually do it. We're actually wondering how successful it can be. I think we're going to really try because we do know that large groups of society don't engage with the technologies that we're using, and we will miss them. Typically, the elderly, the poor, the sick.
Is the intention to use that data to come up with some acuity exposures for different groups?
I think so. I think Miranda and I we haven't spent enough time thinking about this exactly, but I think the intention is that for particular cohorts of people, we want to get a suggestion of differing exposure likelihoods. So it would be really something quite simple, like that slide I showed you at the end of the microenvironments for the individual. So imagine that for a whole population. So, do young children have a very different exposure type in general to older children? I imagine they do. Let's find out. You know, because something like that, down. Do they have different exposures at different times of years, in different countries, by different social classes and ethnicities? So yes, it's an overall assessment of how the what we don't do at the moment, which is we assume the ability to subdivide people out into different cohorts. You know, we think the population is exposed to air pollution because there's a you never have there's a static sensor network in the city that says that Edinburgh has a certain air pollution on a certain day. And it doesn't assume everybody in Edinburgh has that setting. We know that's not the case. Now we want to divide it out into, let's say, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 different types of people. That's much better. We could talk to Alan, we can't answer it perfectly, but that's roughly what it comes to.
Okay, do we have time for one final
question? Yeah, I think we do. We've got 5 minutes, I think.
Okay, Bruce.
Thanks for that really interesting talk. I'm interested in where this could lead, though, in terms of the sort of, I guess, ethical concerns. The no-claim, no-claim lawyers will love this sort of data because
piece of work a couple of years ago at Exeter, where we gave all incoming first-year undergrads, specialist undergrads, a tracking app on their iPhones. And they didn't have to use it, but they locked it. And we were using it to understand how, really interesting idea, how students learned the campus, how they navigated the campus. And then we used that to improve signage and help people flow in different ways. That was the official intention. But what we found, of course, with all these people who weren't sleeping in their bedrooms at night. And so you can, it was very, very, very spatially resolved. You'd know from one room to the next. And they had to go through ethical approval to do this kind of work anyway. But you know, so we didn't report any of that. But we could do. The anecdotes that we've given a lot is that you use Google location history, as I do, it'll be really clear if a certain individual had a home, and they all have homes, then the Google location history knows where the home is, you can normally tell it. What happens if 2 days a week you were sleeping in another room, or in another house, or in another road, and your spouse's lawyer got hold of that? So these are the huge ethical problems with this kind of data. The way we're getting around it in our work is that we, in the end, are aggregating all of this, and we're not interested in an individual in a location or a certain time or a certain place. I've started writing about these ethical problems. I've published something really interesting in health policy about this called Whose Data Is It Anyway? So we're giving this data up, but there's lots of commercial companies really interested, insurance companies not least of which, interested in knowing where you were and what we were doing. So there's commercial interest, there's our potential future insurance premiums if we take private health insurance, interested. We as a GI science community actually do have a role, however, because de facto, without us doing anything, society is deciding that the kind of resolution to the work that I'm trying to suggest isn't appropriate, and as you're probably most of you aware, you read both the popular press and the research literature, nearly all of the initiatives are going down towards confidentiality, locking down things, trying to get data on people at any resolution you can't, because it's geography that's most sensitive to everything. So if you remove the geographical request, you can get lots of data, or if you put the geographical request, then you'll get no other ancillary variables. So one of my big things is to talk and publish to encourage groups like government to say that there is value in this analysis, but we've got to be quite careful about it. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. So thanks for raising it, Bruce, I think a little hobby course of mine.
It is very interesting. I think you clearly would be very careful with your data and what you do with it. I guess it's it's raising the spectre, it's creating a business model for some of these organisations to say, oh, it must be a good idea.
So what's really interesting is these commercial companies like Fitbit. Well, they are, when you sign up to Fitbit, who's signed up for Fitbit? Anybody in the room, I think. So when you click that little yes ticket box on the app, did you realise that was saying, I agree to Fitbit uploading my data, holding it on their server, and selling it on for their profit? Did you realise that?
No, but...
with that story that we never read, that's what it says.
And that doesn't tell you that explicitly. Well, it does.
And I'm not picking on you, just at the end of the room, but you have it. That's a really interesting area to work in. Not many people are, and I'm not really in that space either. What I can be assured is that Fitbit is not recording your geographical location. It's just saying that if you're very lazy, you don't get out of bed.
It doesn't seem to change here.
Thank you very much for all your questions. Thank you all very much for coming. Great to see so many of you. And thank you also to the volunteers for helping. we go to more. Thank you very much indeed to Clive for a very interesting, very timely